the Growing Healthy Pigs podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Growing Healthy Pigs podcast. I'm Ingrid Potter, Key Account Manager for Pigs at MSD Animal Health UK. This is the podcast that talks about key industry news and updates within the pig sector. In this episode, we're bringing you a wealth of expertise from across the globe, and we'll be featuring contributions from speakers at our recent respiratory health conference. The two-day event held at the MSD Animal Health Conference Centre at Milton Keynes featured expert-led lectures, workshops and practical demonstrations covering all aspects of managing pig respiratory health, from ventilation to specific disease threats. So if you're listening to us in your shed, tractor or in the kitchen while you rustle up some dinner, get comfy and stay tuned. When it comes to respiratory health, many people automatically think of porcine reproductive and respiratory syndrome, or PRRS. But in reality, it's much more complex than this. Managing and maintaining pig respiratory disease requires a consideration of a number of factors, including proactive disease prevention, adequate housing, vaccination against respiratory diseases, pig behaviour and farm biosecurity. So let's get straight into it and hear from Serena Shanahan, our Veterinary Technical Manager here at MSD Animal Health Pigs UK, who opened our conference by outlining why respiratory health is so important.
So the idea here, as I said, is to put more tools in your kit to combat respiratory challenges in the field and to understand the challenges that your neighbour or your supplier experiences at the same time. The point being that we are all in this together and it really does need a joint approach. If we consider, for example, some of the challenges for the breeding herds, I'm sure you guys will have a much longer list. But, you know, they're always trying to maximise, well, all of the tools really, but modern genetics and try to achieve best performance out of every pig. But to put all of that together, it's something as simple, just like it says there, if you misread your veterinary health plan or you misunderstand, if you don't have a good manager and you're trying to figure it out yourself on farm, it can all go terribly wrong. Simply just getting your vaccines wrong or the wrong timing can have a massive impact. And similarly for the growers or finishers, you guys have absolutely no control over the start of a pig's life. You're just handed the pig at, as I said, 4 or 5 weeks of age. You also have the challenges, I'm sure you're all familiar with EMB data, trying to keep your antibiotic usage down, under control, and of course weather challenges, which you can have them on the breeding units, of course, but those big tents outdoors are very different to the nice insulated pig huts. And we will be talking about ventilation in the indoor units because that is massively important. I think we all know how important respiratory diseases are and how challenging they can be. We can't see the viral or bacterial particles with the naked eye, and there is the added challenge of them being airborne. So I think probably the only good thing that came out of the coronavirus pandemic is that we perhaps better understand how they spread, how difficult they are to control. Social distancing is really not possible on a pig unit, as we know, and it's not economically viable either. Getting your hands on land is difficult enough as is. So we can't control respiratory disease in the same way that we have done in humans, although we understand better, I think, how difficult it is to control. So the conference over the next 2 days, it aims to address disease behaviour, preventative measures, medicines, genetics, as well as your day-to-day actions on farms. So clean water, cleaning out your water troughs, clean lines. I don't know if any of you have heard Mark Jagger speak very passionately on water. If you haven't, I'd highly recommend it. Just do general practice on farm, scraping out your passages, having your sick pen last. Don't scrape the muck from your sick pen right the way through the entire shed. So anyway, I am about to tidy up. I could go on and on about respiratory disease, but that's what we're here to do. So I will wrap up and pass over to Monica.
Monica Satsinska-Sutton is Technical Excellence Manager at MSD Animal Health UK and presented to the delegates attending the conference about practical immunology and vaccination. Here she shares some key insights on how vaccination works.
So how does it work? Well, vaccination works like infection. It's just that we have control over it and the bug is either killed or we process it in such a way that it is no longer harmful. So the pathogen that is contained in the vaccine is delivered and it needs to be recognized by the immune system. And this is such a fundamental and very important part because it's all chain reaction. Everything has to happen. So The antigen travels inside the body and it's very quickly picked by what I call a surveillance cell. So whatever cell it is, it can be dendritic cell, it can be macrophage, it's just a white cell which has only one purpose in life, to find a foreign alien thing and inform the rest of the immune system about it. So pathogen is found by that cell, and then this cell presents the pathogen to the rest of the immune system. And from that, we will have certain groups of cells. So we will have the humoral response. We will have B lymphocytes that learned about that pathogen and produce antibodies. So we all know a lot about antibodies, very specific little proteins that target the antigen and recognize it with amazing precision. But then it's not all. We also have the cellular response. So there is a group of cells, T lymphocytes, that again learned a lot about that pathogen from the dendritic cell, from the surveillance cell, but they do not kill anything. We call them killers. We constantly talk about cells killing viruses and bacteria, but these cells actually, they kill other cells from the body that were invaded by viruses or bacteria. So here you have antibodies that attach directly to the bacteria or viruses or even parasites. And here you have T lymphocytes that will find cells that were already hijacked by viruses, and they will kill these cells and the viruses inside them. So this is what happens, and this is what happens during the time frame. And this is extremely important because the immune response, as we call it, adaptive immune response, is all about recognizing the pathogen, learning about it, but then remembering for further encounters. So as you can see, after the first exposure to a bacteria or a virus, what you saw in the previous graph happens. So you have the body, the immune system learning, and then they produce the initial group of B lymphocytes that will be producing antibodies, an initial group of T cells that will target the cells. So we have some antibodies produced, but it was the first encounter. We learned a little bit about that pathogen, but then the levels of antibodies decline, but the memory is retained. So the organism, the immune system, remembers about pathogen, and when it encounters the pathogen for the second time, immediately the pathogen is recognized much faster. The B cells and T cells are mobilized, and B cells start producing antibodies. And what is very important is that after each exposure, the immune system gets better and better at producing antibodies. These antibodies are better and better. They recognize the pathogen with better precision, and they are more efficient in neutralizing that pathogen. And after each exposure, more of these killer, super killer cells develop, and again, they are better and better at what they are doing.
This understanding of what a vaccination is and how it works is so helpful for our producers to appreciate what it is that they're actually doing when treating their pigs. Monica then went on to elaborate on this by also delving into what can go wrong with vaccination and how to avoid these common errors.
What can go wrong in practice? Well, everything can contribute. So animal-related factors. So is the animal in the position to respond to the vaccine at all? There is the product-related factor. So is the vaccine in the position to work? So do we give it a chance to work? And us. So did we take care of the process, starting from the production of the product, finished at the animal actually using the immune system to respond to the vaccination and then to the disease? Did we allow it all to happen? So the animal factors will be obviously the age, what stage the immune system is in its development, the genetics. We know there are certain lines that are better at responding to vaccination than others, and then the health of the animal and its physiological status. This is very important. Concurrent infections, and we will talk about, we'll have some examples. Immunosuppression, and this immunosuppression can be due to other infections or nutritional factors, stress. immunomodulation, and I will give you an example of how one infection will influence what the immune system does about the other infection. And then you can have immunological interference. So things that come between the vaccine and the immune system, not allowing it to work as it should. And we will talk a little bit about maternally derived antibodies. And here we are. Pigs have very thick placenta. Very, very little antibodies can go through placenta from mommy to the little piglet. So they are completely defenseless when they are born. The immune system, all the machinery is in place, but there are no antibodies unless there was infection when the piglet was in utero, which is bad news altogether, so hopefully doesn't happen very often. So these piglets are born without antibodies. They get antibodies from the colostrum, and this colostral immunity decreases, the ability of the animal to respond to vaccination increases. Here is the problem. Here is the gap. Ideally, what we would want is to come with vaccination when these antibodies from colostrum no longer interfere, but the piglet is not yet defenseless. Now, this doesn't really happen. So we need to understand how the antibodies interfere with vaccination to cleverly choose the vaccine and how we give it. The maternally derived antibodies, the colostral antibodies, can interfere with vaccination in two ways. Either they will remove the antigen, so we inject the vaccine, but the animal is full of maternally derived antibodies. So what these antibodies will do, they will attach to the antigen, and therefore the surveillance cells, so these cells that have to pick up the virus and present to the rest of the immune system, cannot get to the antigen because antibodies already covered it. The colostral antibodies already got it. As a result, either very few surveillance cells, very few dendritic cells manage to get antigen and present to the immune system, or nothing happened. There is just no antigen to be got. And therefore, there will be no or very few B lymphocytes that produce antibodies, so there will be very few or no antibodies produced by the piglet at all. And when the maternally derived antibodies decrease, piglet's antibodies are not there, so the piglet is not protected. Or the maternally derived antibodies can inactivate the live antigen that was in the vaccine, and it will not replicate. And it is quite a complex concept, but it is important to remember it and bear it in mind. So let's get it together. So what happens is if we have a live vaccine, so vaccine full of live virus or live bacteria, we want it to multiply in the vaccinated animal. The dose is relatively small that we give in the vaccine because we want it to multiply in the organism because it stimulates the immune system the best way. So it is being picked up, it multiplies, there is a lot of it, there is a good immune response. If the animal, if the piglet is full of maternally derived antibodies, these antibodies will attach to that live virus and it will not multiply, which means that we end up with much fewer particles of the virus or the bacteria to be seen by the immune system. And again, it will be low stimulation and therefore there will be either no antibodies that the piglet produces or very few. And as you probably notice, it is not all or nothing. So it's not like certainly there will be nothing happening or there will be everything will be in place. It's a moving feast. The fewer the antibody levels from the colostrum decrease and the piglet gradually is able to respond to the vaccine better and better. That's why we have to remember and bear in mind that the ability of the vaccine to break through maternally derived antibodies will depend on how long these antibodies hang out, but some of them last for months and some only for a few weeks in the circulation of the little piglet. But it all depends what you want to do with the knowledge that we now have together about how these antibodies can interfere with vaccination. We will know, is it live vaccine or is it inactivated vaccines? Inactivated vaccines, we usually put a lot of antigen in the vaccine because it is dead antigen. It will not multiply. So maybe this is what to do, maybe to use vaccine with a lot of antigen in it. Robustness of the live strain. So maybe this, the virus will, from the vaccine will be multiplying that fast that the antibodies from the colostrum will not get it. And then administration route. Is it better to give it into a muscle or is it better to give it into the skin? And then specific properties of the product. And I made it fat and visible because we change the vaccines as a user, but also we as producers change the vaccines. So you always need to take a look at what the insert leaflet states, because it can change. Some of our vaccines were brought to the market several years ago, and we improved them, we changed them. So always check what is the age that it should be given. Maybe there is a difference. How you give it to a little piglet and the growing fattener or finisher. It's very important. The issue of stress. Vaccination does not combine very well with stress because a stressed piglet, like a stressed baby, will produce a lot of various substances that allow it to cope with stress, and one of them is cortisol. It's a steroid that really is not good for immune response and immune function. So do not underestimate how stressful life for a little piglet is. And if we go and do something with that piglet, which is not very nice, the piglet will be even more stressed, not even piglet, grown up pig as well. So there is social stress after mixing and also various things that we do. So I understand sometimes there is just simply no other way but to vaccinate animals on arrival or to vaccinate animals at the weaning time. But let's make all possible to minimize stress for these animals, to give their immune system a chance to respond to vaccination. It will also probably reduce our stress at vaccination as well. There are also some things that can happen to the vaccine. Type of vaccine will determine the immune response. If we use the wrong type of vaccine for a given situation, it can affect the answer. Match with the causative pathogen is very important. Things that happen to the product between the production and delivery to the animals, so the storage, the preparation of the vaccine, they are not all the same. Some you have to reconstitute, some you prepare in a special way, and then administration. And the match with causative pathogen is extremely important. And I always talk about vaccination against diarrhea. And it happens everywhere, not only in pigs, in lambs, in calves. We need to know what caused the diarrhea to use the right vaccine. If we just say, ooh, vaccine, diarrhea, I have a vaccine, that's not a good idea. We really need to be sure what caused the diarrhea. And then the storage. Vaccines are a precious, valuable commodity. Do you remember COVID, the first vaccines, the one from Pfizer? It had to, that was a military operation, a plane with a huge freezer, then the freezer at the depot, and then reconstitution, and then everybody with a box running around. This is because vaccines are a delicate product and we need to treat them with respect. Vaccines need to be kept in fridge, most of them, vast majority, and they do not react well to warming or cooling too much. So live vaccines that contain live viruses or bacteria, they usually do not contain anything that keeps these Wrigley's inside them in any cushioned way, because they assume we will take care of that. So they are very sensitive to higher temperature. So these vaccines, really, if it is stated 2 to 8 degrees or 2 to 4 degrees, it means not 20, because this desactivates the pathogen in the vaccine. And do you remember my story about them multiplying? So if they die, suddenly you have a dead vaccine, although you paid for the live vaccine and you will want to use it as a live vaccine, but the pathogen is dead, so it will perform differently. Vaccines that contain killed pathogens contain adjuvants, so we want to help the immune system to respond to the vaccine, and they are nowadays very fancy. These are complex solutions, and they don't like freezing. They really, really get destroyed very easily. Do you remember these fridges? If your fridge is, your thermometer in the middle of the fridge shows 2 degrees, it means that at the back of that fridge, close to the wall, it's zero. So if you put a box of vaccine at the back of that fridge, and God forbid touching the wall, it will freeze, which will destroy the vaccine. So if it is intramuscular vaccine, we should not give it subcutaneously. Vaccination hygiene, that's a serious thing. Equipment, do we take care of equipment? We can have a super vaccination gun that is essentially rusted and not working properly. Antigenic interference, so, you know, unless it is said in the insert leaflet, you can mix these two vaccines, don't, because one vaccine will kill another. And let's do not forget, one of the main reasons why vaccination fails is that it did not happen at all. And I always use this, and apologies if it sounds a little bit ridiculous, but sometimes we do literally vaccination into the piglet. God knows which part of the piglet gets the vaccine. It's very important that the vaccine ends up where it should be, because it may not work, or we get ourselves into deep problem if we want that piglet to grow to a finisher and this to become Easter ham. I always say vaccines are a little bit like these tractors that now one can buy for a lot of money, that have and GPS and music inside and airco and God knows what else. It is important to understand how they work, to use them successfully. And unfortunately, like with this tractor, technology doesn't compensate for the wrong use. So it's worth putting an effort into understanding how the vaccine needs to be used and follow the instruction. It doesn't work off-road or an empty tank, so let's remember that it goes into an animal that has to be in good position, in good health, good nutritional state to respond to the vaccine. And if we take good care of these vaccines, they will be like that super duper GPS. They will give us their best. So that's all. Thank you very much indeed.
Next up was Jordi Balies from Spain, a vet from GSP Interporc, who gave an update on porcine reproductive and respiratory syndrome, also known as PRRS. He explained how in Spain they're seeing an increase in more virulent strains of PRRS and how they're working with producers to try and minimise the spread of these strains.
I have divided my presentation in these four parts. First, a short introduction about what is GSP Lleida, where I work, and the objective of this organisation. I will continue explaining some problems with the new PRRS virus strains regarding the virulence. And I will show some practical experiences about how we manage in Spain the control of the PRRS virus. And I will finish with the tame home messages. The GSP Lleida is a non-profit association with the objective to manage, to design, and to put into practice disease control programs. The pig producers finance our association. You are located in Lleida. Lleida is in the northeast of Spain. Lleida is between the two regions with more than 50% of the pig production, so we have a lot of information of the disease we detect in the field. We are more than 30 workers in our association, divided in these areas. The most important area is the diagnostic laboratory. We are offering to our partners special prices to do the diagnostic. We also are offering to the producers environmental assessment. And finally, we are coordinating disease control programs, and also antibiotic reduction programs in the farms and in the companies, because in Spain, the main model in the farms is integration companies. The integration companies is like a franchise where the owner of the pigs is not the owner of the facilities. And so we have more than 75% of the farms in this integration model. It's a problem because we have a lot of information. In Spain, we are sequencing a lot. And when we have a lot of information, what, as I mentioned in the first slides, we can typify the strains. But sometimes we can do something, we can apply measures to reduce the risk of new strains creations, or in a country or in a region, to reduce the new strains introduction. For example, in a farm, we can vaccine piglets, but we recommend not vaccine piglets when the prevalence or the percentage of viremic piglets is high, because the possibility to create a recombinant increase. The European Medicines Agency recommend not use two different MLV vaccines, MLV modified live vaccines, in the same farm. And if you want to change your MLV to other MLV, the EMA recommend to establish a time break between the two. These are, for example, some practices that you can do in your farms. But in a country, it's important also to try to reduce the new introduction of strains. We can introduce this new strain with the movement of live pigs, because there is not restrictions with the movement of pigs related to according to the pig virus status, except boars, because in Europe, in 2021, we have a new legislation that, following this new legislation, this legislation only permits to move boars, we can move negative boars from farms. And all the stats may have to be naive, for example. But if you want to move in the majority of the countries in Europe or other parts of the world, if you only have, you want to buy positive piglets, you can buy, because Pierce virus is not a restriction to move piglets between countries. In Spain, we have increased the risk because we are increasing each year the number of imported pigs. We are importing boars, we are importing replacement gills, we are importing finishers and piglets, because we are producing a lot. And when we increase the imported piglets, because normally the boars and the replacement gills are negative, we are monitoring in the introduction of the sow herds. But in our association, we are trying to convince the producers that these producers import piglets to monitor and to typify if the parties are viremic or not. And unfortunately, more than 70% of the parties we import from other countries, the Netherlands, Belgium, Italy, are viremics.
Interesting updates there from Jordi and how PERS is being managed in Spain. Great to hear about how these diseases are being managed in other countries. Our final pick from the conference comes from Hugh Crabtree of Farm Energy and Control Services, who hosted a really engaging session on the importance of correct housing and ventilation to support the performance of our pigs. Hugh shared insights from his years of experience and took insightful questions from those in attendance. He opened with the basics about principles of ventilation.
So, how do we get the ventilation right in a building? I propose we understand the basic principles, and they are basic, for reasons which you will soon realise. And the basics are things like heat balance, capacities and constraints, and how air moves. So understand the basics and apply them. That's a good start, right? Rather than make it up as we go along. So what are the basics? Let's have a look at heat balance. Who can tell me what the A, S, B, and V stands for? The A is for animal, H is for heat. So the heat of the animal plus the heat of the S is supplementary. So anything that we are adding, that we have decided to add to that shed, the heat of the animals plus the heat that we have chosen to add, if we've got a growth stage where we need it, like a farrowing room or a nursery building where we need to add some supplementary heat. Okay, so that's on the left-hand side of the equation. What's the B? And that's the balance. Now, the flaw to this whole argument is that this is steady state heat balance. So it's steady and we've taken a snapshot. You know as well as I do that the reality is we've got a very dynamic situation. But you have to start somewhere. So what happens? What happens if we've just emptied three pens of pigs in a building? You reduce A. And it goes out of balance and finds a new balance, which isn't where it was. What happens if three of our 2 kilowatt bar heaters blow up in our nursery room? Same thing. The left-hand side of the equation goes AWOL. What happens if we haven't got a grip on the ventilation rate? If we're all over the shop, we're permanently putting this that we're trying to keep in balance out of balance. Result, pigs are thinking, oh, I was comfortable 5 minutes ago. Who's messing about? So the heat loss in a building system, which, by the way, remind you, we put up to modify the climate, it depends on the temperature difference between the inside and the outside. So if it's cold outside, we have to be quite careful what we do with ventilation, because small changes will make big differences. Conversely, if it's hot outside, there's nearly nothing we can do, because it will always be hotter inside than it is outside, because we've got sensible heat output from animals going on. So the building heat loss is a calculation you can do to work out what the insulative value of the building components are. What are the building components? The floor, the walls, the roof. And you, anybody familiar with what a U value is? It's a measure of thermal transmittance. It gives you an idea of what the insulation level in the shed is, or in the building or the room. And when we set up in business, if you had a U value of 0.6 in your building, you were doing a hell of a job. These days, there isn't a manufacturer in this country that would supply you a building for pig production that has got less, that is worse insulated than about 0.35. So a lot more insulation we're using now. Ventilation heat loss, same things based on this term, this delta T, this is the temperature difference. It turns out in metric units that the ventilation heat loss is a third of the rate measured in meters cubed per hour times the temperature difference. Those little bits of information are worth having, because you can then get on a site and do a quick fag packet and say, what are we expecting to happen here? It's the reason for sort of shit. And this is basic stuff, right? We didn't need a degree to do this. So we've got a lot of animal heat going into the room or into the building. We've got an outside temperature and an inside temperature. Obviously, we're trying to control the inside temperature. We've got some loss through the building structure itself, and we're stuck with that, because however the shed is built is however the shed is built. A week next Tuesday, we're not going to roar in and put three more layers of styrofoam or something in the building. We've got what we've got. So that's a pretty much a constant. But we are controlling ventilation rate, and it's ventilation which is the dominant remover of heat. What's the average temperature in the UK? It's in that 11 to 12 degrees. Here's a really good one for you. Over what ambient range, that's outside temperature, over what ambient range should we expect the buildings we've put up to modify climate to work? Okay, so I'm suggesting sort of minus five to plus 24 is probably a reasonable starting point. Okay? The maximum ventilation rate that we specify for a building is there to remove the excess heat of the pigs. That's the constraint. To get it to be 18 in the shed when it is 19 outside, you need infinity ventilation. You can't have it. There's only so many fans we can fit in the wall, or there's only so big a hole we can make in the side to put a curtain in. So you have to accept a specification constraint. That's really what I'm trying to impress on you. The minimum ventilation rate is there to sufficiently dilute the contaminants and deliver sufficient fresh air for the pigs to be able to live. The lower we can make it satisfactorily, the more in control the building will be more of the time. So if we're over-ventilating at the bottom end in cold weather, we are going to have no control of temperature. If we are under-ventilating in cold weather, we may not be sufficiently diluting the contaminants that are in there. So, you know, your 100 kilogram pig is turning out the same sort of sensible heat that your peg lamp's turning out. So you end up with quite a lot of heat in a finishing shed. Tens of kilowatts that you're trying to get rid of. Note the difference in sensible heat output when you're at lower critical temperature compared with when you're at upper critical temperature. And upper critical temperature is what? It's when the pigs decide, I'm struggling to get shot of this heat, so I'm going to stop eating. It's just what they do. If I'm too hot, I'm going to back off taking more megajoules into my system because I can't get rid of the blighters, because I don't sweat. I can only wallow. Or I am in a straw-based shed, which worsens the effect in hot conditions because you've now stuck an insulation between me and my heat sink, which is the bare concrete, preferably wet. Can't get rid of the heat, so I back off eating. Lost production. And there you have the explanation for why my rule of thumb, I can make a note of this, this is a useful rule of thumb, it's 2 meters cubed per hour per kilogram of live weight in growing pigs. The ventilation capacity installed should be 2 meters cubed per hour per kilogram of live weight. Now, that's to do what? To provide adequate air to make sure that it's only 3 to 4 degrees hotter inside than it is outside when everything's running, because we have a constraint. We can't have infinity ventilation. And bearing in mind that the average temperature is 12, and if we're restricting the capacity of the system, however we do it, with curtains and wind or with fans, if we're restricting the capacity to maintain a temperature lift in hot weather to 3 or 4 degrees, and we want it to be 18, we're getting into trouble as soon as we get to 15 degrees ambient. So there in a nutshell is why we start running into difficulty quite often, quite quickly. Fan capacities, really just to give you a bit of an idea about how many pigs based on that 2 meters cubed per hour per kilogram of live weight. So your typical 450 millimeter in old money 18 inch fan, about 5,000 meters cubed per hour, it's about 25 big pigs. It's not much, and that's the point. We have had a tendency historically to over-ventilate buildings. We now have sort of rather flipped the other way and have a tendency to under-ventilate buildings. In the German systems, they accept a bigger inside-outside temperature difference. So they don't mind if it's 6 degrees hotter inside than it is outside, whereas UK engineers would typically try and restrict to 3. And the Danish engineers say, we'll use the sensible heat output at upper critical temperature. So we don't need as many fans because we haven't got as much animal heat. So you pay your money and you take your choice, and you will probably either have your own experience if you're keeping pigs, or your clients are describing. We seem to run out of puff a bit quick on this system. It's probably because the installed ventilation capacity has been supplied, in my book, short. Again, the whole point of this chat is understand the starting point physics and where the constraints are, because that way, well, you might better specify the buildings, I guess. ACNV, metre per second of wind speed, 97% of the time, which means if you've got a hole 1 square metre on one side and a 1 square metre hole on the other side and a one, you've got the capacity of a 15-inch fan. And when we did all the original ACNV buildings, it pretty much worked out as a 2-foot deep hole the full length of the building, more or less every time, which is why the pictures I showed you originally look like they look. And it's why they were so successful, because that just worked, mostly. Another basics I want to talk to you about. Outlets do not. What is an outlet? It's where the air goes out, clues in the name. Outlets do not affect air movement in the building. We're going to have some good discussion around this when we're talking about big hole, straw-based buildings. But the principle is actually the same. It's where the air is coming in that determines air movement in the building. And if we want to engineer systems that are predictable in terms of air movement, we want the air to get to where we want it to get to, we don't want drafts on the pigs, we've got to have a high inlet velocity, which is why Silso called it the high-speed jet system. We need a high inlet velocity to make sure that that flow of inlet air is blown into the building fast enough to get to where we want it to get. And you've got to point it in the right direction. Bit of easy maths. Volume, which we've discussed, is our way of controlling temperature and is therefore variable, equals area times speed, which I've just said is constant, or needs to be constant to be predictable. So what does that say about our inlet area? If you want a stable airflow in the building whilst you are controlling ventilation rate to control temperature, to keep the airflow stable, you need to be controlling the inlets, which is why, ladies and gentlemen, we've finally arrived back at having controlled inlets in most indoor grown pigs building systems.
Great practical tips there from Hugh, and I hope you can take away some to implement on your farms. So there we have it, folks. A great conference was had with some really practical advice given for both vets and producers alike. We hope that this brief overview has provided our listeners with some of the key take-home messages from the conference. A little food for thought, perhaps. If you'd like any more information on what you've heard here today, or you'd like to talk to one of our advisors on how you can improve the respiratory health of your herd, please do get in touch via the link in the podcast description. That's all we have time for now, but as always, thank you for listening to the Growing Healthy Pigs podcast. We'll be back soon with another episode.
The Growing Healthy Pigs podcast.